This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tom Nichols is our guest today. He's a national security scholar at the U.S. Naval War College, a Twitter provocateur par excellence, and author of many books, the latest of which is Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy. Welcome back to On Point, Tom.
Thank you, Meghna. Good to be back.
Well, yesterday we primed the pump a bit and asked listeners, are Americans narcissists, really political narcissists, because politics feels so polarized right now, is the problem actually us? And that's all we asked. Do you want to hear a little bit of what people had to say, Tom?
Absolutely.
All right, here goes.
Hello, Meg. This is Joe from Worcester, Massachusetts. Welcome back from vacation. Now regarding Mr. Nichols. The grammatically correct statement is that the problem is we. I am very concerned that we are becoming a nation of snowflakes. Our people are told to wear a face mask to prevent the spread of a horrible disease, and they throw a hissy fit and act like two-year-olds who don't want to eat their vegetables.
Hello, this is Gil Wooten from Maryland. Mr. Nichols is correct in saying, like Pogo, that one enemy is us. But the public is not our only enemy. No one listens to unaffiliated individuals when they try to put topics onto the agenda of public discourse that have not been chosen by politicians or journalists. Journalists jealously maintain control of the agenda. Journalism is a vehicle of power, and humans have never been willing to relinquish power, even in small amounts. Thank you.
Hey, Meghna. My name is Michael Lant. I'm calling from Michigan. Unfortunately, there is also this bend of American arrogance that makes everyone believe that they are experts on every subject that they have an opinion on. A perfect shining example of why something like Trump's big lie in the last election and claiming that there was this massive fraud, which of course everyone who understands our electoral system knows there wasn't, is because when people don't understand it, their ignorance can be exploited for political purposes. Just another example of American arrogance and our unwillingness to work, to understand anything, and instead just want our beliefs reinforced for us.
Hello. I want you to quit picking on voter suppression, supposedly. It is not. Don't you read? I read the bills. So, imbeciles, either start reporting right, or like I said, I'm bearing down on you. You know you're going to be out 2022 because the Democrats are going to lose a lot. And then we're going to put our president in. And you know something else? This fake about voter suppression. If somebody is too stupid to get an ID, they're too stupid to vote. Okay? Get that through your head.
There you go, Tom. Narcissist?
Wow.
What do you think?
You know. Well, first, in my own narcissistic way, I'll thank the guy who talked about experts, because that's what my last book was about. And, you know, he's got a point. the lady who's screaming into the phone, I think makes the point that, somehow they're going to vote in 2022 and they're going to get even with you, Meghna Chakrabarty, because it's personal, and we're gonna put in our president, not your president. And I agreed with the guy from Worcester. You know, being a fellow Massachusetts guy myself, I mean, people really view everything that they're asked to do as this remarkable, imposition on their personal autonomy. Which I think, you know, as I talk about in the book, you know, is really what happens when you have a country where there's high levels of affluence and high living standards, and people get used to the idea that almost any inconvenience is like a failure of government. And I think that kind of summed it up right there.
Oh, we have more for later in the show.
Oh, I bet.
but in your book, really, you're taking on the a challenge that I think a lot of people in this country are worried about right now, and that is our democracy, our very democracy itself, feels rather fragile. So just briefly, I mean, you have many different reasons for that, but diagnose for us so that we have a solid place to start here. What is the problem? What's causing this sense of fragility around our democracy at the moment?
Well, I don't think it's just a sense of fragility. I think it's a real fragility, and it's happening not just in the United States, but around the world. One of the reasons that I wrote the book is that I didn't think this was just a kind of flash in the pan problem because of one election or, the past two or three years. When you look around at places like Italy, India, Poland, the United Kingdom, Brazil, all of them are in the grip or have been in the grip recently of populist movements that are based on just unfocused rage, voting as revenge, voting as punishment of other people. One of the things you hear a lot of, it's a quote I use in the book, but you heard from a lot of people, is the voter who said she had voted for President Trump, but she was unhappy now because he wasn't hurting the people he was supposed to be hurting. That's all of these attitudes are completely uncivic. You can't sustain a democracy on voting, weaponized voting on the idea that, our president versus your president, and basically, electing people for entertainment value. And so I think that fragility is real because I think people no longer think seriously about politics and take politics seriously. They don't participate. That's another problem, that even when we talk about, my God, the country is in such a mess and what are we going to do? In 2020, we patted ourselves on the back for getting about 65% of the public out and only about half of the youth vote. And we thought we'd done a great job.
Yeah. But the thing that you write about in the book, which is really the new take here, is you're asking us that if we believe, this is from the book, if we believe democracy has failed us, we should first ask ourselves whether we have failed the test of democracy. And the point that you make is that it's vital to ask this question now because we've actually come through this post-war period, this half century of, if you take sort of this 30,000 foot view, of unparalleled prosperity on average, right? Longer lifespans, an economy, the number one economy in the world, more freedoms than ever when viewed historically. And you say that it's those very achievements that have the unintended consequences of undermining the characters, the characteristics essential to a democracy? Tell me more.
Yeah. And people bristle because they say, well, we're not really an affluent society. Well, yes, we are. There is income inequality, which is a political problem and a different problem, but that's different than rising living standards. We are a country that's been at peace, even though people, again, scoff at that and say, but we were in Afghanistan, we were in Iraq. But we, particularly since the Vietnam War, we have asked almost nothing of society since we outsource this to brave volunteers who do it, as a tiny minority of the country, and they carry that burden for us. And we have gotten used to remarkably high living standards. I mean, we are the country that loses our mind if the Wi-Fi goes out. We're the people that get upset when we stand in line at the DMV for a car that our parents would have thought was a technological miracle and a luxury. The way this happens is that there's a term I didn't coin, but it's hedonic adaptation. It's people get used to a very high standard. It's kind of like if you slept in a king bed all your life, queen beds suddenly seem like a real imposition and they're terribly uncomfortable. It's that people have gotten used to these things in part because they have been come so easily, and that they have now decided that on top of this, of course, there's culture of narcissism, which we'll come back to, but they, in a sense, we live in a situation where when you've lived with a lot of convenience and long life and health, I mean, we talk about, my dad had a heart attack in 1974, and it was practically, there was practically a wake that convened at my house that day because, they were certain that, well, you have a heart attack, that's it, it's the end for you. My father lived another 35 years. So this combines with the narcissism problem. And for 40, 50 years now, and this is empirical, social psychologists have tracked this around the world. We are becoming a more narcissistic society. We are becoming a more society of loners. We are people who do things alone. We don't care about other people. We think about ourselves. We believe that our views are the most important thing in the world. We are performative. This was a word that even Christopher Lash talked about when he wrote a landmark book about narcissism over 40 years ago, that we've become a performative culture where we think that nothing, you know, that doesn't happen in the public eye matters. And when you put all of that together, democracy simply becomes this kind of annoyance where you just expect everything to work and you don't think you really have to participate in it very much if it doesn't please you.
Okay. So we just got about a minute to go before the first break. But to distill this down here for a second, are you saying that our democracy is in danger because life is just too easy? Should it be harder?
There's a great quote in the book from a British writer who said, "The problem with modernity is not that it is hard, but that it is easy." And I don't want life to be harder. I mean, I don't want us to build, I say this in the book, I don't want us to build our identity on, you know, blood and iron and war and misery. But I think this is why in the book I ask people, step back, take a look at yourselves, ask if things are as bad as you think they are, and maybe stop saying that you live in the worst time ever, because there is no standard by which you are living in the worst time ever. It's simply not true.
Well, we are talking today to Tom Nichols. His new book is Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And hop on social media. One of the ills that Tom Nichols says is afflicting democracy. But go to Facebook or Twitter. We're at On Point Radio and let us know what you think. Do you think this problem of narcissism, of the benefits of 50 years of peace and prosperity are actually inadvertently undermining the strength of American democracy? Again, we're at On Point Radio. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tom Nichols is with us as well. He's a national security scholar at the U.S. Naval War College. His new book is Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy. And we've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And in the book, Tom argues that the current political partisanship, the political divides, the fragility of our democracy are not, quote, oddball moments in an otherwise healthy polity, but signs of a growing irrational and illiberal self-indulgence among an increasing number of voters and their elected representatives. In other words, he says, the problem is you, the problem is him, the problem is me, the problem is all Americans. And we've got some comments here on Facebook. Alex Davidson says, of course, until we elect different politicians with different outlooks, the U.S. will continue to repeat old mistakes. Dan Bryall says, of course we need to look in the mirror. The partisan divide is such that party comes before actually learning the facts. We the people voted our corrupt representatives in, and we vote to keep them in as they sell average Americans down the river. Well, let's listen to another call that we got from a listener on why she thinks that we have to look in the mirror when it comes to what's causing the cracking or the fraying of American democracy.
And my name is Irene Machia. I'm calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. And I just wanted to comment that I believe our society does a really good job of segregating people by socioeconomic status. If you are a high-income person, it is very unlikely that you have a close, intimate friendship with a low-income person. And without a cohesive, coherent society where people of different educational and economic backgrounds are in really meaningful relationship with one another, I think we're going to struggle having a really meaningful democracy as well. We've seen this with the pandemic. I mean, there are plenty of people who are perfectly happy to wear masks if it means protecting others, even if they are low-risk people themselves. But there are a lot of people who really feel like it's my body, my choice, and I don't have to do anything to protect anyone else because I can do what I want, and that's my freedom. But I don't think that's universal. And I wish that with respect to public education, that we were doing a better job of teaching people, teaching students and young kids the values of collectivism and taking care of others in a society, and that it's part of living in an organized society, let alone a democracy. Thanks.
Well, let me bring into the conversation Jack Beatty. He's On Point's news analyst. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna. Hello, Mr. Nichols.
Well, you just heard that listener there talk about how socioeconomic divides, she sees that as part of the problem here, even in a time, as Tom describes in his book, of continued, sort of on average, unparalleled prosperity for this country. Your thoughts, Jack?
Well, I want to put some of that claim and others under a little friendly pressure. Prosperity. Well, here we have Thomas Piketty in his opus, Inequality, big book several years ago. He says, income inequality in the United States today is probably higher than in any other society at any time in the past, anywhere in the world. It would be tedious of me, superfluous of me, to point out how different that situation is from the world in which Mr. Nichols and I both grew up. But just quickly, in the 1960s, real family incomes went up 41%. Since 1979, the growth in real wages for men has been 8%. In the 1960s, the gap between CEO pay and average worker, it was 24 times. The CEO got 24 times now, or even 10 years ago, 200 times. The share of income going to the top 1%, in the post-war era, it was minus 26%. That is, the rich were being taxed. Since 1979, the share of income to the top 1%, 119%. This is not prosperity, and nor is this just a static economic condition. It leads to political inequality, the silencing of the voice of people who can't pay for politics, and it leads to political polarization. If there is any finding in recent political science, Mr. Nichols doesn't include it. It's the researchers of Nolan McCarthy and his associates pointing out the causal relationship between income inequality and political polarization. Now, he talks about resentment and ressentiment and all, but doesn't trace it to its natal point, which is this large and outrageous level of inequality in the United States today.
Well, let's give Tom Nichols a chance to respond. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah. When I was writing the book, I wrestled with this because this is kind of the standard explanation that, you know, the Piketty book and income inequality. And the problem is that real people in the real world aren't acting this way. For one thing, the average intellectuals and people who study economics understand multiples of income inequality. The problem is that when you look at how people are actually acting, they're not they're not angry about the people that are vastly wealthier than they are. They're the people that are angry about people who are a little wealthier than they are. And this was, you know, Eric Hoffer called that one back in 1951. He said that the small differences are the ones that generate resentment among us. I've never seen the article Jack refers to. I just don't think that or other attempts to do this have really shown that this is the problem, that this is not a move. And the reason I say this, this illiberal movement in the United States that's concentrated mostly on the right and mostly among white people is not a movement of the poor and the dispossessed. It just isn't. It's a middle class. It's a bored, lumpen bourgeoisie, middle class movement of white people that is mostly, I would argue, about race rather than economics. In Britain, the Brexit crowd, they are not the poorest. They are not the people that are dispossessed. They are they were the middle class. The five-star movement in Italy. Hungary, which has one of the lowest measures of income inequality in the developed world, is actually one of the most illiberal and fast decaying democracies of all of the countries that you can talk about in this problem. I mean, it's just it's an argument that sounds that moves us emotionally, because you say, wow, you know, in 1960, the multiple between a worker and a boss was X. Well, yeah. And in 1960, the people who are nostalgic, and I talk about nostalgia a lot in this book, the people who are nostalgic for this period also forget that, yeah, a man could afford to keep a family of three in a tiny apartment in New York City because women didn't work. Minorities weren't a competition for jobs. Living standards were bare minimum in tiny amounts of square footage. Medicare didn't exist. There was pretty much, if once you retired, you died shortly thereafter, and on and on. I mean, it is a completely artificial comparison to a time when we think that because things were more equal, therefore, we had a more stable democracy. And part of the problem is that the nostalgia always centers on those magic 15 years of immense manufacturing capability in the United States that had to end by the early 1970s and was never going to come back. Maybe part of the difference I have with people always call me a boomer, but I'm I don't know what I am. I'm a kind of tail end boomer, or Gen Jones, or geriatric pre-Xer, or whatever I am, because I was born in 1960. I grew up in the early 1970s. All of the misery that people talk about now was completely visible in my little factory town by 1973, 74. And so I think we're taking this argument about income inequality, which is a real problem because it suffocates economic activity. Concentrating all the wealth at the top means that, you know, their entrepreneurialism gets suffocated. Spreading the wealth through the social safety net gets suffocated. I'm not arguing that income inequality isn't a problem. I'm saying that to keep trying to locate the illiberal movement in the problem of income inequality empirically doesn't hold water anywhere, from the United States to Italy to India to Brazil. This is largely a middle-class movement of bored people who want to give their lives meaning because they think their lives should constantly be interesting and important.
Jack, go ahead.
Well, I'd like to see the data for that. I mean, that's a claim. It sounds like the kind of thing you'd read in a literary critic might say. But against that, we have real conditions. Now, it's true that people don't, that there were all these problems in the past that the technology and gadgets have made better. But, you know, you say people should, we need to, all of that is constant. That is, each era has its panoply of gadgets and ease and so on. We can't, so even then people thought, you know, whoa, boy, I can turn on my color TV and it's great. So I don't buy that argument that people should recognize that things are better because we have more gadgets. It's all relative. And I'm not claiming, and no one, the serious students about in this, Larry Bartels, prominently, who's been on our program, I'm not claiming that income inequality has caused the Trump dysfunction, has caused this Trumpist attack on democracy. No, but it's an antecedent condition of everything that happens. politically in this country. And as I say, it is established by political scientists that it's a cause of political polarization. It's true that ethnic and racial resentment in poll after poll is the leading driver of the Trumpist attack on democracy. They don't want democracy because democracy will vote them out and will promote things they don't want for minorities. That's clear. But you just can't separate the economic element as a— put it this way. Suppose the conditions in the 1960s had continued. And suppose that, or even better, 1979. According to Larry Summers, if taxes had remained what they were then, each American in the 99% would have $12,000 more a year. The very richest Americans would have $700,000 a year less. And with that dough, they buy out politics. They're buying out the Democrats now on the Biden social service bill. The second claim, I won't go on, but I don't want to belabor this, but your claim also about, you know, lack of civic virtue. Well, sure. But what happened last summer? 15 million people turned out to protest the injustices of visited upon African Americans, most of them predominantly white. That was an exercise in civic virtue of a kind I've never seen in my lifetime. And, you know, you say, well, of course, they were doing it and they were spreading the pandemic. Well, okay. The point is, it was civic. It was even in that regard, heroic civic virtue. And it was peaceful. 93% peaceful demonstrations. That's not a culture of narcissism. That's a lot of civic virtue.
Well, the two things I'll say. First of all, Jack can keep talking about income inequality is the driver of this. And he's very focused on it didn't cause Trumpism. He'll grant that. The problem is, I'm looking at this not just in the United States and not just in the past 5 years. The fact of the matter is, when you look at voting behavior, when you look at where the rubber meets the road and people actually go and express their preferences, this kind of illiberal behavior is almost overwhelmingly a middle class behavior. It is the people who are, in fact, living well. The people, and I say this both anecdotally and with data behind it, the people who, like my friend, working class guy, who was complaining about how screwed up the world is and how America had really done him dirt because he was calling me from his boat. When you have Trump boat parades, something has gotten weird. And when you look at movements in other countries, particularly the Five Star Movement, which was started by millionaires, I mean, this is, you know, this notion that somehow this illiberal impulse is finally, you know, the underclass rising up and saying democracy has failed us. It's a great story, except that people aren't actually acting that way. And Jack's point about the protests last summer, you know, my argument is that people protesting and having great outpourings of short-term justifiable emotional rage is not the same thing as consistent participation. You know, we had gigantic protests about Vietnam, and then the youth vote was written into the Constitution. And from then on, the young people who will still, when I was a kid in the 70s, when I was a college student in the 80s, would turn out by the hundreds of thousands and millions about things like nuclear weapons, still can't budge the needle on just showing up to vote.
Tom, so let me add a layer here, because I think that what you're putting your finger on has existed for many generations, in fact, and there's a place here where Jack's analysis and yours, I actually believe, overlap, because income inequality wildly exacerbates a problem that I would like to use George Orwell to identify, because in one of his best books ever, in my opinion, is The Road to Wigan Pier, where he writes about seeing firsthand the lives of dirt poor coal miners in England. But that's actually not the best part of the book. The best part of the book is when he looks at his own class, so that he identifies as basically the lower middle class. And he says they're the most dangerous of all in 1920s England because they know what they do not have above them. They are not the aristocracy. They are not the very wealthy. And they are mortally afraid of losing anything that would propel them down to the level of the working class. And he says that fear provides an attitude which is, quote, a sniggering superiority punctuated by bursts of vicious hatred. And in this country, I would add that that bursts of vicious hatred is inextricably intertwined with racism here.
With race, exactly. And I think that, you know, and I, of course, I bow to Orwell in the book because one of my fears is the kind of hyper proletarianizing, you know, of a working class where, you know, we just drown kind of the going from Huxley to Orwell, where we just drown each other in cheap leisure and entertainment so that we all check out. I'm far more worried about that than I am about the effects of income distribution right now.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about what to do about this, about the narcissism that Tom Nichols is identifying, about how this liberalism is inflamed, further inflamed by the income inequality that I know Jack and I care about. So we'll get to it when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tom Nichols joins us today. He is a national security scholar at the U.S. Naval War College, author of many books, the most recent of which is Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy. And we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Jack Beattie, our own On Point news analyst, is also with us as well. And lots of comments coming in. Tom, we've got here Chris Galicious on Twitter saying collectivism was never part of the capitalist blueprint, so what did we expect would eventually happen? Extreme narcissistic behavior has always been encouraged by the economic and governmental system that we live under here in the USA. D.R. Shervish says, Kurt Hahn, the educator Kurt Hahn, who escaped Nazi Germany, was the founder of the modern adventure education model and said, we need to provide youth the moral equivalency of war, or they will tend towards fascism. Sheila Fay says, narcissistic U.S.? Yes. Also lazy. How hard is it to move a cart to the cart corral versus blocking a parking space? Now, Tom, there's other aspects of why you came to this conclusion in the book, and I want to give you a couple minutes to unspool them a little bit. One of them actually does have to do with recognizing that that people are struggling and are suffering here in the United States. I mean, you talked about your dad a little bit, but healthcare and the fear of being, you know, one medical bill, for example, away from bankruptcy, that stuff is real, but it's being exploited somehow. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure. Although, really, I wrote the book because of those shopping cart issues. That was it. The last shopping cart I moved, I said, someone ought to write a book, and that was it. But, you know, that's a small part, and I'm laughing about that, but there is something to that, that the kind of daily lack of basic cooperativeness and civility really is an indicator of how much we just don't care about each other anymore. I mean, it really is in your daily life. And when people say, what can we do about this? I say, be the example that you want to set, hold a door for somebody. It's amazing how little rituals of civic life can improve that. When talking about things like medical care, I mean, I accept all of the education, housing, medical care, these costs are out of control, and these are policies that we actually can fix. These are all within our grasp. What I took issue with, and part of the reason I wrote the book, was that voters, ordinary citizens of democracies, jumped from these are bad policies that need a better solution to this entire constitutional experiment is completely screwed up and we should just dump it. And somebody strong should come in and hurt people I don't like and reward me. And that is not the answer. I mean, and I actually point out in the book, part of it's called Converse's. It was actually talked about by a guy named Philip Converse, and then Fenno's paradox, Richard Fenno's observation. First, that people don't really understand political ideologies, and they use parties as kind of markers for location of their general wants and desires, but also that people don't want to throw the bums out. They want you to throw your bums out. Mm-hmm. They don't want to actually, everybody talks about how much they hate Congress, and yet they love their own congressperson. They reelect them. You know, the United States reelects its members of Congress at like 95% rates. The Senate, because of the longer terms, a bad year for the Senate is when only about 85% make it in. You know, one of the reasons I wrote this is because after Trump was elected, there was this constant talk about a populist revolt, a populist uprising. And I kept looking around and saying, if you were a Martian and, as you say, the 30,000 foot view, you'd see no evidence of this. And in fact, I think it tells you something that the people who elected Trump ostensibly on policies like the deficit and healthcare and education, he did nothing for any of those things, exacerbated them, handed tons of money to the rich, made income inequality worse, and they loved him for it because it's about a culture war among people who want their self, that for whom politics is self-actualization and soothing their internal resentments about their own problems with their life. And when that is what democracy becomes about, it's no longer a democracy. Then it just becomes war against all, of all against all, because you can never satisfy those kinds of resentments and angry weaponizing of politics.
Jack Beatty, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that's a very vigorous and persuasive analysis of a sort of democratic distemper that we seem to be suffering from. I don't argue with it at all. But I want to draw our attention to something else. You say it's a time of peace and prosperity. Well, here we have that's arguable at least. Here we have Spencer Ackerman in a 400-page book called Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. And he writes, a war that never defined its enemy became an opportunity for the so-called MAGA coalition of white Americans to merge their grievances in an atmosphere of righteous emergency. And he's saying the war on terror and has been a perpetual part of our life now for 20 years, adding to the insecurities, stoking the resentments, focusing the hatreds. And it was there for Trump, and it was antecedent to Trump. And yet you say this has been a time of peace.
Absolutely. Spencer's been making that argument for a long time, and I understand it. But again, what is the lived experience of people? And I talk about this in the book. Unless you are in the military or part of a military family or community, as I am, by the way, I live in a Navy town. This idea that somehow the war on terror has been this great burden that we've all been carrying around. I actually talk about this in the book with reference to my daughter going to high school. I began high school in 1975. Vietnam was very much in my life. I was 15 years old. I had really spent a good part of my childhood thinking I was going to be drafted. It was going to be, it was on my television every night. I knew where Vietnam was. All my classmates did. I think of myself as somewhat post-boomer because I was the first high school class that began when there were no combat troops in Vietnam of any kind. To contrast that with 9/11 and the war on terror, the war in Afghanistan, as I wrote in The Atlantic, I mean, part of the reason it dragged on for 20 years is we just stopped paying attention to it. We just didn't care. We outsourced it to volunteers. We said, you know, go do good things and keep the bad guys over there in the away game. We weren't drafted. We had no resource shortages. We didn't suffer a war tax. It wasn't on our televisions every night. It mattered a lot to national security experts like me who studied it and to people like Spencer Ackerman who wrote books on it. But the lived experience of your average kid or young person was this is something far away. I don't ask people where Afghanistan is even now. Ask them to point to it roughly anywhere on a map and see what happens. The fact is, we checked out. The military had a saying, America's not at war. And I use this in the book, and I cite it in the book. America's not at war. We're at war. America's at the mall. And that is part of the democratic dysfunction that I'm talking about. The Cold War and Vietnam were far more intrusive in the daily life of the average American than the war on terror ever was after about 2005, 2006. Once we pushed those away games, handed them to volunteers on exhausting multiple deployments, we forgot about it. And one of the things I would cite as evidence for this is all the people, you know, beating their breast about the war on terror, that didn't turn into better funding for veterans, for their health care, for the VA, for any of the things that are hard. We were okay with the performative stuff of putting bumper stickers and yellow ribbons on our cars. But when it came time to actually say, now, how are we going to take care of these people? You know, how often are they being deployed? Should we maybe come home? We just didn't want to talk about it. We didn't want to hear it. It's absolutely been a long run of peace and prosperity since the end of the Cold War.
Well, but I would just offer that what also happened was that the spectacularly massive expansion of the national security state went on for so long in this country that it became utterly normalized and therefore mostly invisible to us. But not that it did not have an impact. And also, as Americans, we collectively chose to forget after a few years about the impact, especially that it did have on Muslim Americans as well.
But Magna, I have to point one thing out. Just recently, I wrote a piece about the Afghanistan war, and there was a great comment on this by someone who's been following the electoral issue here. If you really think that somehow this has not been a time of peace and the way that Americans have approach their politics about it. I think it was Steve Biddle who said, you would have to get an electron microscope to find the impact of Afghanistan on any congressional elections in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
Well, I totally agree with you about the expansion of the national security state. And that happened during the Cold War as well. And that had a pernicious impact on us because we internalized that national security state as well. But in this case, we just conducted a 20-year war, and we just didn't want to think about it.
Yeah. You know, overall in your book, though, I will say that the threads that you draw together, they're quite clear to me. I mean, the debate about the effect of prosperity and peace that I'm so glad Jack has brought into this conversation, notwithstanding, I mean, there is, look, one of our listeners on the on social media, in fact, I think pointed out the best that like we have an economy and a culture that is centered on consumerism, not necessarily citizenship, right? And so, therefore, the focus of on the you, all it seems like it one of the negative outcomes can absolutely be this trend toward narcissistic illiberalism, as you're talking about. But we're running out of time here, Tom, and I want to hear a little bit more from some of our listeners because I'm seeking solutions as well. Because our democracy is at stake, and it does matter. So here's a little bit more of what people called us yesterday, of people calling us yesterday and sharing their thoughts.
Ben Siegel in Madison, Wisconsin. Do I think this is my fault when I look in the mirror? Yes, partly. Like many who are somewhat politically engaged, when an election is coming up, I tend to engage in a flurry of activity, maybe do some volunteering on the phone or door-to-door, encouraging people to vote and so forth. Once that's over, I tend to fall back into just following the news and politics rather than engaging with it. because it's exhausting. But I also blame Americans and I blame our system, and these are topics that are covered endlessly on NPR. They're problems where we know the solutions. Key to them is teaching civics again. Americans don't know jack about their government.
Hello, this is D.W. DeGan. I'm calling from Keyport, New Jersey. No, I don't feel I don't feel personally responsible for the current culture. My political views are pretty much what they were pre-September 11th. I think most people would characterize my politics as classic New Deal liberalism. At the same time, I'm also a lifelong gun owner and shooter, and a 10-year combat veteran of the current wars. Most of my life, those were not incompatible views. But right now, in this current climate, I don't think either party really has a home for me. So who do I blame for this? I don't know if they originated it, but I blame Congress, because basically what they've done is they've bypassed debate, given all responsibility to the executive branch so they can blame whoever happens to be in office, which conveniently leaves them with no real responsibilities. And you can see from their actions that they haven't actually done much. And in my view, this has been a betrayal of their office. Those are my views.
My name is William Nordman. I'm from Winchester, Virginia. I keep seeing the two words of freedom and democracy as the rights of the people. But I note that the R in these words, however, is forgotten. The forgotten role of the citizen, responsibility. I believe people should do a little more digesting than protesting, do a lot more volunteering than vandalizing, and dig deep into their soul, the soul you were given to present yourself as worthy. Remember that freedom and democracy are not God-given rights. They are the gracious gifts that can be bestowed upon people who take responsibility for their actions.
Okay, Tom, we've got 2 minutes left here.
I swear to God, the last caller was not me hiding my voice, but that was perfect.
I want to say something. So we've been focused on illiberalism and on the right here, but on our show a while ago last year, you also talked about how you think part of the problem is a moral relativism that comes out of the Progressive Academy too. So it's like a culture-wide critique you have here. But what is the road back from this?
Once again, I'm going to say what the road isn't, because I'm not sure I have a good solution. But, a couple of your callers have said, well, the answer is in our institutions like education. And I have to be Debbie Downer here and tell you, the most illiberal people in the United States, which is to say the people that are really driving this in the United States and in Western Europe, are middle-aged folks. Again, people closer to my age. When I went to school, that was the golden age of public education. I had civics. I didn't go to a private school. I came from a working class family in a working class factory town, and I had to memorize Supreme Court cases in eighth grade. Most of us of that age had that education, and yet this generation of, say, people 55 to 75, they're the ones that are sitting around passing around Facebook memes about Barack Obama being born in Africa. So education can teach you facts. It cannot teach you virtue. That has to come from within families. It has to come within communities. It has to come from being a participant in the life of your community in some way, even again, if it's just putting a shopping cart back, because the magical notion, we have never been, and I'm going to, I don't want to light Jack's hair on fire again, but we have never been a more educated public. We have universal high school graduation. We have remarkably high rates of college attendance and graduation. And that's not helping anything right now. So education is great, but virtue is the answer. And I think we have to, again, look within ourselves. We should, as one last solution, take on small projects that people of both parties can do and succeed at. Stop trying to solve the Constitution all in one shot and in one election, and take this piece by piece and get used to working with each other again.
Well, Tom Nichols, his new book is Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy. Tom, it's great as always to have you. Thank you so very much.
It's been wonderful to be with you, Meghna.
And Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. Jack, your mind and your analysis strengthen this show every time you're on. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Go plant a tree in your neighborhood. Maybe that's a start. This is On Point.